You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Bernard Cooper, the author most recently of a first novel, A Year of Rhymes, published by Viking, also of a book of poetic essays called Maps to Anywhere, published in paperback by Penguin. The first thing I noticed when I was reading A Year of Rhymes was that the style was radically pruned back from the book of essays, and I wondered why.
Well, my intention in this book was to write a novel that had the sort of simplicity and directness of a ballad almost. And I knew that I would have to prune back the language that characterized some of the work in my previous book in order to put more emphasis on the narrative and less emphasis on the style.
But why would you want that?
My previous book, I think, was for me a kind of long-term experiment in style. And I was interested in trying something, again, just more simple, more direct. And I felt that it would also be easier to deal with prose that was simpler and more lucid throughout an entire book. Another thing about the first book, Maps to Anywhere, was that the pieces vary greatly in length. Many of them were only a page, sometimes two, three pages. And I think that it's a different experience to read a collection in which you can sort of savor or take time with a shorter piece. And I was a little bit worried that that dense language would be a real trial for a reader over the long haul.
For me, what I found was that I genuinely missed it,
mm-hmm.
and that I found myself thinking that something very odd was going on here. And since I know the earlier book so well, I found myself thinking, is this a strategy? Because, for instance, in this book, the boys make phony phone calls. They call several times asking for someone and then call back saying, this is so-and-so, were there any messages for me? And this seems like the oldest phony phone call in the book. Whereas, you know, in the earlier collection, you have boys inventing funny names and messages. And it seemed as if almost here that this would be like a generic book. Like there would be no memory in it that 8 out of 10 people you spoke to wouldn't have. Was that a plan?
No, not really. In fact, a lot of the material for the book was based on my own memories and my own experience, actually, with the death of one of my brothers when I was much younger. So it wasn't really a strategy. I mean, again, my intention was to simplify the style, but I don't think I had any sort of overall strategy in mind when I did that, except again for making a more readable, a more lucid narrative that would be longer than the pieces in my previous book.
Because for me, the oddity about this book is that, say, advertisements at a certain time would ask you to imagine the pleasure a family would have over a newly designed kind of Jell-O. But one doesn't imagine this pleasure being had outside of an advertisement. In your book, people exclaim with great gusto over Jell-O, highballs, you know, all sorts of things that one assumes are just imaginations of enjoyment that advertisers have.
Well, that's funny because, you know, immediately I think of having grown up in a Jewish household and hearing a tremendous number of exclamations of great joy and great delight over food, over, you know, satiation and over the pleasure of different tastes and different flavors. And, you know, I also remember that a lot of the experiences in which my family was all together took place, as is the case in most families, around the dinner table. And those exhortations over the beauty of food seemed to come directly to me from memory and not really have anything to do with advertisements, although I think that my family was fairly typical and Americanized in the sense of loving to try new frozen foods and Jell-O and things of that nature. But otherwise, I didn't think of it as having a connection to advertisement.
Well, you see, I found myself... There's an odd tone in the book. At first, I tried to ask myself, is this facetiousness? It's not. It's not irony. It doesn't sound sincere to me, though. It sounds like someone miming sincerity. And so I found myself finding something mannequin-like about the nature of, you know, busy ants coming in. What are they doing? They're wiping their aprons, of course. As if everything had been tapped to make sure that it was slightly false.
Again, a lot of the scenes in the book are directly from memory, and my memory of the women in my household congregating in the kitchen and the men in the household congregating in the bar, and that strange sort of division between men and women when I was growing up. The memories or the sentiments involved in this book are sincere.
Mm-hmm. I guess it interested me because what I thought was happening as I read the book was that all of these somewhat weighted objects, conventional objects, were being rhapsodized in a way that made me feel very sad and slightly nauseous.
What kind of objects are you talking about?
Consumer goods, tract housing, that kind of stuff that in other purposes usually gets tipped and we're in camp land where things are being celebrated because they're lousy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Here, there's a kind of, I really like your new skirt. And yet, with the way in which it's said, and the 50s style, one says, well, no, obviously you don't like the new skirt. Well, who doesn't like it? The writer? The character? But something in the tone is so busy being sitcom-derived or something that I found myself feeling, God, this is a room very eerily full of people who are deader than the dying boy. And then when things started to fall, things falling out of the window, and a local genius girl, Marion Hirsch, who wants to be an artist, starts making mobiles where things float, I thought the book was heading toward some kind of apotheosis where all of these objects would finally rebel against the somewhat complacent use to which they were being put, and all of them start flying. In fact, it seemed like that when people started tossing things out of windows, when the character makes mobiles, that everything was about to go aloft. And so I found myself, honestly, I guess, bewildered because of the first book, thinking that this was a book that was being directed thematically, but being left somewhat in the lurch. But these were my expectations mm-hmm. being violated.
Well, as far as the kind of kitsch or all-American images that are used in the book, my sense of them was I wanted to try to exploit the sense I had when I was growing up, that my family, who were second-generation Jews, tried to surround themselves with those sorts of objects that represented American life, that represented a place in the status quo. And there is a kind of falseness in that, definitely. And for me, that was a source almost of sadness. So perhaps some of that sense of the objects that are mentioned in the book exuding something sad or even morose in some way may have to do with that. My intention was to portray a family of second-generation Jews who wanted desperately to fit in. And in their attempt to lead a life that was, economically sound and where everything was functioning smoothly, surrounded themselves with these kinds of objects. Of course, what's going on, though, is they're realizing that that complacency can't exist, that death intrudes in the case mm-hmm. of the son, or the nascent homosexuality of the narrator of the book. So there's a sense of that they're going to experience the kind of impending loss of their place or their security among these objects.
Well, that was what interested me. One, that perhaps because neither death nor homosexuality have been, can fit here, that to some extent it felt as if revenge had been taken as in a fairy tale where everything turns to stone. And although people are behaving, when you first enter the great hall, everyone frozen in their posture looks lifelike, but they can't move. And so it felt as if there were some kind of fairy tale curse cast on this family in which no one would be able to be personal. That they would all have to talk about, well, how did it go at the office today? Or, this one, she's a real, And it seemed to me a very eerie effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I think is going on in the book is that people, I've often found that people sometimes would prefer to talk about the weather, let's say, or other banalities or trivialities than to talk about what, in fact, is sort of impending or imminent or unpleasant. And there's plenty in this book that's impending and unpleasant with the death of the brother. And my sense was that people were sort of shying away from their capacity to deal with that or to steep themselves in that realization. And in a sense would talk about other things that were lighter, things that were easier to cope with or easier to digest or share, definitely.
I'm talking to Bernard Cooper, whose first novel, A Year of Rhymes, was just published. For me, the book, an aunt has given the hero Bert a book that contains poems for every day of the year. And the novel you've written is also organized seasonally, although, to my mind, comically, the seasons are
out of kilter.
out of kilter and presaged usually by an disaster. California style, a season comes with the beginning of the fire season. But I found, I guess, in the other essays, art seemed to be the solution or a somewhat wizardly approach to the world, the Bruno Schultz thing. And so while they, the society, might be providing the home of the future, you, the writer, were providing a very individual and quirky prose style that was somehow going to swallow the plastic and encase it somehow in poetry. Here, the book of poems began to emblematize my confusion with the book. Were these poems being sneered at? Well, I guess not, because some of them were good poems, although some of them were crummy. Mm-hmm. And I began to feel as if this book, A Year of Rhymes, was somehow about a world where art couldn't invade, where Marion Hirsch would make sort of an entry there, but her work seems sort of dumb. Mm-hmm. She may not want it to be, and she may be as close to a weirdo as this neighborhood has seen, but that's this neighborhood. So it seems like a world in which art has entered in transvestite form, in the form of this book, A Year of Rhymes, and that some of the poems do intimate something that art might be able to help with, but most of them don't. and that there's, am I completely off base?
I think what happens is that the aunt reads poems to the narrator with this sort of hope that they will illuminate aspects of the world that he's about to enter. And for him, they are only kind of baffling and mystifying. Both good poems, Blake and Yeats and Edna St. Vincent Millay, and more sort of schmaltzy poems. And he doesn't have a strong sense of the difference between the two. And it's true also in terms of Marion, to move on to Marion, that in terms of her presence, her work isn't noble, it's not extraordinary in any way, but it seems to me, in the way that certain amateur art can be extremely
touching
effort to transcend the mundane or to offer some sort of alternative to, well, in this case, to the gravity that kind of pervades the book, her work is not good in maybe an art historical sense, but her intentions are good. Mm-hmm. And that was what was important for me to convey.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's, I guess I kept expecting somehow, maybe the book jacket flaps mention of Bruno Schultz, I kept expecting that all of this, what I'm calling audio animatronic tone, would eventually give way to something spooky and totally wearing blended, toward which Marion Hirsch's work was only an approximation. But this book really seems one in which art won't come to the rescue. You know, art won't come along with a poem to make death a bit more palatable. It won't come along with a perception that will give the young boy a recognition of what his homosexual feelings are. It seemed as if these were going to be characters who are going to be caught, like fruit and jello, suspended in a thick world of cliches.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a sense, that's really true. And I think that was part of the gravity, or one of the strains of sadness that runs throughout the book, is that I think the narrator, the 11-year-old boy, would like to find his place, would like to think that there's the possibility of perhaps understanding his identity or seeing it corroborated in the world at large, on one hand. And on the other hand, seeing his brother somehow rescued or saved. And certainly art or poetry presents itself occasionally as a possibility for that to happen. But you're right, it doesn't. And I suppose that one of the sadder elements in this book, for me at least in terms of writing it, is a sense that art does not save a person. As transcendent and wonderful and important as it is, it cannot thwart death, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, obviously, but art sometimes constructs not a solution, but an escape, an alternative universe.
Right. Well, and I think in a sense it does when, for example, the boy goes to Marion's apartment and sees that everything that he had cast aside, that he and his brother had thrown out the window, specifically memoranda that were at the father's office. It was the first day of the new year, and people were throwing all this, well, to them, garbage out the window. And he was fascinated by all this refuse, this dross from the past year. And he picks it up and he puts it in his pockets. And when he goes home, he discovers that Marion has returned to the household. And she sees these memos and asks if she can use them. And in a sense, I think he's heartened by the fact that somebody can use the extraneous or the throwaway elements in order to at least make an effort to make something transcendent or beautiful out of what other people are throwing away.
You've mentioned gravity now twice, and the scene in which people are tossing the old year's business papers out of the windows in celebration of the new year seemed to begin in the book a thematic where things started to lose gravity and started to float. The mobiles were another. Could you talk about that?
Well, in a very basic way, one of the two kind of emotional strains that run throughout the book are, in a sense, the kind of goofiness and pleasure and ease and even banality of family life. And on the other hand, the sadness and sometimes moroseness of seeing a family member decay, or in the case of the narrator, feeling that the world is a world in which he will never find a place or never quite belong. You know, I think that what happened about halfway through the book is that those two elements started to braid together, started to work in tandem. And, you know, I don't know if I was trying exactly to make some sort of overarching thematic point with it, but I was really interested in, after a point, in exploiting images that have to do with gravity or death or the inability to transcend ordinary life or to find a way out of the inevitability of death on one hand, and on the other hand, those sorts of moments of forgetfulness, of joy, of... I mean, even there are moments even where I think the kind of small talk that you were mentioning in the beginning among the family is a kind of almost an offering that allows people just to forget for a moment what's happening. And, you know, my own experience with my brothers who have died and, of course, friends who have died of AIDS is that, I mean, there's so little kind of consolation ultimately that you can give to people. But forgetfulness in its various forms seems like one of the consolations to be had.
You know, it began to feel to me, I'm reminded of this strange quote of Valéry who says, God made the universe out of nothing, but he let the nothing show through. That these are people whose nothingness opens onto less painful nothings, you know, so that they do. They talk about the weather, or they watch Queen for a day. They watch, well, I guess this is it. They watch publicity and media, as Adorno says, reifying misery into something else, into a spectacle of pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons for the mother's sort of obsession almost with Queen for a Day, apart from the fact that there were so many housewives who were fascinated by that show, as I am fascinated by that show now when I've been lucky enough to see reruns, is for the mother it was the sense that tragedy, that misery, that untoward fates and circumstances were something that happened outside the family. And it was almost a way of her alleviating, again, her sense of the impending death of her son to watch this and to have that period of a half an hour when she felt that tragedy or misfortune was something that happened to somebody else. There's something else, too, that happens in terms of advertisements, and I'm not sure if this is exactly the section or the scene that you're getting at. But at one point, the boy is reading a magazine. I think it's Good Housekeeping or something like that, while the aunt and the mother are whispering about the brother's physical condition, thinking perhaps the child is distracted and not listening. And one of the things that the child confronts at that point are images of trusses and you know, teeth whiteners and all these kinds of symbols or products in advertising that seem to suggest that any sort of frailty of the flesh or any failing of the body can be overcome in some way. And that was the sense in which I was very interested in using advertisements or trivialities in the sense that it presents, I think, for all of us, I mean, no matter how much we sort of scoff or think of ourselves as being apart from the lure or the seduction of advertising, a world in which not very much bad happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really interested in kind of exploring that.
I'll be straightforward. This is a very odd book for me. Because I know you, I know your writing, I know the previous book. And it seemed as if there was one way in which tenderness and naturalness was meant, and then another way in which the prose style, the suburban stuff, the 50s cocktail parties, that language came to press against the possibility of sincerity, making everything sound radically insincere and slightly echoey. And I found myself, I guess, I know that the book is meant to be a sincere book, but I found myself more interested in the echoes and the falsenesses and the way in which the book seemed to allow death to win, not in the form of the brother's actual death, which never arrives in the book, nor in the form of the boy's sexuality, which never takes shape in the book, but rather the sense that these people are on display, as in a museum, mark the suburbs, the 50s.
Well, first of all, I mean, you're right that I was sincere in writing the book, but not, of course, unaware of some of the grimmer or more eerie tones that you know, take place in some of the scenes. One of the scenes that I think is literally echoey, to use your word, is a scene where cocktails are being mixed in the rumpus room, which literally has a kind of echoey feel going on. And there is, at that point, I think, a kind of hollow effort for the family to enjoy themselves, to share a social time, to forget this kind of impending misfortune. What happens, however, in the scene is that one of the parents' friends mixes a cocktail, which is called a rainbow cordial, which is some sort of layered drink in which different liqueurs, I guess, have different weights, and you can pour them. If you're careful enough, you can pour them in such a way that they layer each other, and you get a drink that's made out of these various colored strata. And suddenly the fun or the pleasure or, you know, the aim toward kind of heedless enjoyment becomes, well, literally stifling, and people are unable to move because they're afraid of interfering with this kind of delicate balance of this odd artificial drink that they have. And in fact, at one point, somebody laughs and upsets their drink. It's Marion. And it kind of sloshes
mud.
churns into mud. So definitely, I mean, I think my sense of sadness, my sense of the gravity of some of the things that I was dealing with in the book is there. But you're right, too, in the sense that there was a kind of eerie hollowness, a sense of defeat that runs throughout the book that I was interested in exploring as well.
I've been talking to Bernard Cooper, the author most recently of A Year of Rhymes, published by Viking, the author as well of Maps to Anywhere, published by Penguin, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. You've been listening to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. Please join us once again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.